presentation. And before I introduce our speaker for today, I just wanted to announce that on March 30th, Sam Wade, who's the chief of the Transportation Fuels Branch of the Air Resources Board for California, is going to be here, and he'll be speaking about promoting alternative fuels under California's low carbon fuel standard. So that will be on March 30th. It should be a really interesting talk. And then April 6th, we have Green Electricity Service Under Local Control, Implications of Humboldt County's New Community Choice Energy Program. And for that, there will be a panel with including Arnie Jacobson, who just walked in, and Matt Marshall, Sean Marshall, and several other folks will be part of that panel talking about community choice energy. And on April 13th, we have Mary Ann Piet, who's the Director of Building Technology and Urban Systems at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. She's going to be talking about commercial building control systems and energy management, current challenges, and future directions. That will be April 13th. And at the end of April, April 27th, we'll have Darren Spies, who has written a book called Defending Giants. It's about the Redwood Wars and the transformation of American environmental politics. So that will be another. So we have several more speakers coming to talk with us this spring. But for today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Michelle Medley Daniel. Michelle is a 2005 HSU grad. She graduated with dual degrees in art and in liberal studies in English. And she's from Hayfork over in Trinity County originally. She went back to Hayfork and has been working with the Watershed Research and Training Center there as the program manager for networks and development. And she's going to tell you more about what all that means. But since 2013, she's been the co-director of the Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network, working directly with member communities throughout the United States. She does a lot of traveling and helping them improve wildfire resilience. And the title of her talk today is Harnessing the Power of Generative Networks to Improve Society's Relationship with Fire. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks so much, Yvonne. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate being invited to come and share some of what I've been learning about wildfire in my community and in other communities around the country with you guys all tonight. So I appreciate you coming out. And as we go through, we will have lots of time at the end for questions, but if there's things I'm saying where you're like, I should ask a question, that's fine. Go ahead and ask during it. And I'm going to stand over here to advance the slides, but you know, if anyone can't see, like, take time to get a better seat now, I guess. And I think we're going to get some sound control by this nice person. So thank you so much. So up on the screen, we have a beautiful view of my hometown community. This is Hayfork, like Yvonne mentioned. This is the view of Hayfork from one of our many fire lookouts. This is Plummer Peak. And I want to talk with you guys tonight a little bit about the fire story of my hometown. Just a little background on Hayfork. It's a little community, about 2,500 people. It's in the center of Trinity County, the geographic center, so just your neighbors to the east. It's a resource-dependent community. For a long time, its economy was driven by logging, and then with the decline of the logging industry, we've sort of been trying to reimagine what Hayfork could look like economically and in terms of our relationship with the landscape. And that's where the organization that I work for, the Watershed Research and Training Center, comes in. The organization was started to find some new solutions to how the community could relate to that landscape. And so we've tried a lot of different things and learned a lot about options for how to make money relating to a public landscape. So just a little bit more context. If you looked around at the mountains there, most of that land is public land. About 72% of Trinity County is U.S. Forest Service forest land. And then we have another bit of BLM, so about 82% of the entire county is public lands. So that leaves not that much private land. It's mostly in the valley bottoms like this in Hayfork. And that leaves you some interesting challenges in terms of management, because you're really managing not just with the 2,500 people that live in your town, but also with the rest of the citizens of the United States, your backyard. So that's the context that I come from. So now I want to tell you a little bit about the fire history of my community. So this map is from our Community Wildfire Protection Plan. This map shows fire footprints through 2009. And so this was the last time we had officially updated our CWPP, and you can see there's been a lot of fire on the landscape over that amount of time. But since 2009, we've had a lot of other fires. So in 2012, we had this fire. So this is Hay Fork again. That picture I was showing before is a viewpoint from about here. So we had the Stafford fire that started in September. A woodcutter was out there and ended up with a spark that started this fire. And about 4,500 acres and several evacuations later, we have a burned area right on the east side of town. And then 2015 happened. And 2015, some of you may remember, in July, I think July 31st, we had a lightning storm that caused hundreds of fires across the North State. In Hay Fork alone, the Fork complex had 40 different fires that were started. And there were huge fire complexes in Ruth and upriver in Denny, in Higham Palm. There were over 200,000 acres that were on fire in August of 2015 in just the Trinity County Humboldt area there. That doesn't even include these other fires on the edges. So in spite of a ton of money and resources, like these bombers, that picture's from the Fort Complex in Hay Fork, and over 2,500 fire personnel just on the Fort Complex. So we had double the size of our community in terms of the people that were there. We still lost homes, and there was a lot of property damage. To give you kind of a sense of the cost, in 2015, the U.S. Forest Service, which is the agency who has to foot the bill for our wildfires in this country, spent $1.5 billion on wildfire fighting just in 2015. So this is what town looked like that summer. That summer, we didn't really get a summer that year. We had 23 days of hazard level air quality where we couldn't really leave the house except to get in our cars and go to other places that were indoor. We had extended evacuations. Like I mentioned, we had several home losses throughout the county. And you might be thinking, well, man, we should have got on those fires quicker and put them out before they became so large. Maybe we could have had more planes. Maybe we needed more firefighters there. Maybe if we had, you know, additional funding or new kinds of technology, we could have dealt with this issue. But that's not actually the conclusion that I came to and not the alternative I want to propose to us tonight. So instead of a fire suppression paradigm, which the story I just told you is sort of how it was enacted, I want to talk a little bit about an alternative way to relate to fire, a way that builds, instead of suppression resources, builds community resilience. So what I want to propose is a new fire paradigm for us. If we think of fire as something that we need to fight, if we think about being in a war with fire, we're losing. We're losing firefighter lives every year. We're losing homes. We're losing control of our budgets. And we're definitely losing healthy ecosystem function. And so we need an alternative to that. And this is an awesome little chart. I'm a big fan. The folks from the Joint Fire Science Consortium put this out in their digest. It was a project looking at fire futures, and a bunch of fire and social scientists got together to think about how we might change the current system we have for dealing with fire and shift to a new paradigm. So you might ask, how do we make that shift, though? If this is a $1.5 billion a year industry, basically, and a whole approach to managing fire and landscapes, how can you make a change that helps us actually move from those columns on the left to the columns on the right? So the way we do that is by learning to live better with fire within our own local communities. And that's where this concept called fire adapted communities comes into play. So I'm going to share a little bit about what that is with you tonight. So it's, of course, not just the people of Hay Fork who have realized that fire suppression is not probably the best route to keep staying on. There's a lot of other people who have known this for a long time. And even people in policymaking decisions have known this. And so there's been a sort of an ongoing effort to look at our fire management policy in the country. They do quadrennial fire reviews. And one of the ideas that was born out of that was that we needed a cohesive national wildfire strategy that would basically help us make that shift from the fire suppression paradigm to maybe a new way to get things under control and contain costs and save lives. And so they developed this vision up there. They aren't getting rid of suppression altogether, as you can see. They want to safely and effectively extinguish fire sometimes, use it where we can, and manage our resources to actually live better with fire. So this might not sound like a big difference in terms of what we've been doing, but it is a big difference. The Forest Service's policy had been put it out by 10 o'clock a.m. That was what the status quo was. Any fire, we need to put it out. And so this does represent a big shift in approaching fire. So you can see the goals there. They've split these out into landscapes and communities and response. And I see those as kind of silos, and I prefer to think about fire-adapted communities as the umbrella and the thing that actually includes good response and healthy landscapes and healthy communities. So I don't actually, that's not my favorite way to break things out, but it is the way that they've broken them out in the cohesive strategy. So if they want to promote this idea that we could adapt to living with fire better, the first obstacle is explaining to people what that might look like. And if you work for the government, you know that it's a challenge to present new programs all the time. People can sometimes feel a little whiplashed with, oh, here's the latest thing that you need to do, and here's another thing you need to do. So here's some important things to know about what FAC is and what it's not. So it's not actually a government program that's getting a funding stream. It's an approach that they want to promote and that they want communities to adopt. It's also not a recognition program. There are other recognition programs out there that help say, like, you are FireWise. Like, that's the most famous recognition program. But there are some sort of philosophical issues with recognizing communities and maybe inviting a sense of, we're done, when what we really want to invite is, we need to engage in this forever. So we're very specific about it not being a recognition program. It's also not a policy or a mandate. It's not something that people are required to do at the national level, but there are policy and community kinds of level codes that can really help enforce and bolster an effort. It's also not something that lies just in the purview of experts, of, you know, fire managers or land managers. This approach requires everyone in a community to think about how they can engage with wildfire and what role they might be able to play. So no one's getting off the hook here. We can't assume that a red truck is going to show up and save us, or a green truck. We've all got to be thinking about wildfire and acting, not just thinking. So I want to talk a little bit next about what some of the essential ingredients of a fire-adapted communities effort look like, and then tell you a little bit about what some of the actual actions that people would take are. And then talk more about some outcomes that people are getting from taking this approach to fire. So local people learning and working together is absolutely the foundation of fire adaptation. You can't adapt locally if you don't have people who live in the same place taking responsibility and working together on the issue. When people do come together to learn and work together, they can create new kinds of community capacity and resilient relationships, and then they can engage more members of their community, and they can think about things like vulnerable populations and think about ways to bring those people in. That will help build on their sense of shared responsibility and help all of them work towards a better fire future. And then the other two things that are really important here is that you have to continue to act and adapt before, during, and after fires. So local people working together, building community capacity and resilience, and working on an adaptive management kind of cycle of before, during, and after fires are the really important parts of how you create fire adaptation. But then what's the actual work that you do together? So that's the next thing that I want to show you guys a little bit of what our members are doing. How I like to think about fire adaptation actions is kind of like a ripple in a pond. So if you have the pebble in the middle, you can think of that as like the individual or family. And there's all kinds of things that people can do in the place that they live. So you can make sure that you don't have vegetation that is creeping up on your house that's going to burn it down. You can make sure that you have a family evacuation plan, that you know what you're going to do with your livestock or your pets. You can make sure that you have the right kind of vents and that you've done all your home hardening. The most likely way that your house is going to burn down is if you have a shake shingle roof. And so if you have one of those, you need to figure out how to get that, get a new roof. That's your like number one thing you could do. Don't want that roof. So there's things that homeowners can do. And as homeowners take action, then neighborhoods start to become safer. Because if I'm taking care of my property, but my neighbor's not taking care of theirs, and they have a shake roof, when that shake roof catches on fire, all those embers are going to come over into my yard and catch my house on fire potentially. And so that's when you start to really need community relationships, and you need to be able to start working together, because we can't do this in isolation in just our own houses. So we have to work as neighborhoods. And that's where programs like the FireWise program that help people work on their houses and help neighborhoods take action come into play. But we can't really stop there either. We can't just say, oh, well, all we need to do is like scrape up vegetation that's around our houses and have better roofs. That won't actually fix our fire management paradigm. That might save some neighborhoods from burning down, but it won't change our cultural relationship with fire. So to do that, we have to work at an even bigger scale, and we have to think about our governance systems. So what kinds of codes and ordinances do we have? What kind of development are we incentivizing? What kinds of industry do we have that maybe will change our relationship with that landscape and either create risk or mitigate risk? And then we have to think about how we're doing collaborative planning. Are we actually making space for people to learn together and to plan what to do together? I think this is an area where we can always do more. It's very easy for professionals to do planning together. And then what about all the rest of us? What have we learned about what our county's emergency management plan is? It's hard to figure out good ways to invite general citizens into those processes, but I think it's really important in terms of building resilience to try to find good connection points and to think about the learning and try to communicate that. So there's a bunch of other things we can do at the even bigger scale. If you remember back to my photo of Hayfork, one of the things we've invested really heavily in is creating a local workforce that can actually work on the landscape and treating that bigger landscape. So not just around our houses, but what about all that public land around us? What about that 200,000 acres that was on fire in 2015? What kind of work had we done in that forest to prepare it? And how was the fire going to interact with that landscape? Had we done our jobs as stewards, or had we kind of taken the value we wanted from that land, excluded its natural process, and left it to whatever was going to happen? So really thinking about our responsibility to those lands and taking action to do projects out there is sort of that last tier. And that requires us to partner sometimes with land management agencies if we're in a public lands context. Sometimes it requires us to work across boundaries and work with public and private partnerships. A lot of the people that we work with in the network work with really large landowners. One of our staff members, who's a wonderful woman that some of you may know, Lania Quinn Davidson, she works for UC Extension and is part of our program. And she works with large ranch owners and helps them get burning into their programs and get fire back onto their landscapes. She did, indeed. So if you take all those kinds of actions at various scales, what kinds of outcomes can you expect? So these are some of our network members, these jolly fellows there. These guys didn't know each other before they joined the network. They live in a place called Island Park in Idaho. And now they're like buddies. So you get stronger social ties. If you know your neighbors, you are going to be a lot more well prepared to survive any kind of a disaster, whether it's being evacuated due to a wildfire, whether it's an earthquake or a tsunami. Knowing your neighbors is one of the most critical factors in people getting what they need and getting to safety. So if we want better outcomes for people, then we need to get people to know each other. We also need to make sure that we've done that work at our houses, that we have not sort of been like, well, I'm gonna get to it later, and August rolls around and we have our wood pile stacked under our deck and we have vines growing up on the side of our house, because what's gonna happen then is the firefighters are going to drive right past our house and they are not going to try to stop there. They're not gonna try to save our house, and we're gonna feel probably pretty badly if our house ends up catching our neighbor's house on fire because we didn't do our work. So we want to know our neighbors, and we want to take responsibility for our own work that we need to be doing. And that'll get better outcomes for people and protect the sort of infrastructure assets that we have built on the landscape. But we also get to feel good about what we're doing for that larger landscape. That landscape that's actually the landscape here and the landscape in Trinity County are adapted to fire and need fire. There are tons of species that are fire dependent, that can't regenerate without fire, or that need fire to produce food for them. And so allowing fire to exist on those landscapes is part of our responsibility as people who live on them. So we've been kind of selfish in trying to keep fire out so that we can build out into the wildlands as much as we want and think that we can control all of it. And we kind of need to reel that back in a little bit and think about what our stewardship responsibility long-term to that landscape is. And that way, when fire does come, the landscape can be happy and can flourish, and all those fire-adapted species can get the fire that they need. We can also be really kind to the federal budget. I mentioned that the Forest Service has to foot the bill for all of our firefighting on public lands that are federal, and that's the majority of the firefighting budget. It's projected that the firefighting bill in 2025, which is not that far away, is going to be around $2 billion. It's a lot of money. If you think about what we could do with $2 billion if we didn't need to be having bombers out there every day, we could do a lot more pre-work. We could invest in a lot of community resilience, and I think we could get way better outcomes. We're spending a lot of money to get not good fire outcomes. And so while we might be doing sort of the best we have with the system that we have, I don't think that if you presented me with the landscape that we got in 2015 and said, would you like to pay, you know, $50 million for this? I think I would say no. I would not like to take that deal. I would like to take the $50 million and put 100 of our local people to work before that fire, get a whole bunch of work done in that forest so when the fire comes, we don't need 2,500 firefighters to come from as far away as American Samoa. And instead, we can manage that fire, let fire do its work in the wildlands, and not be so afraid that it's going to burn down our entire town. So the kind of new fire paradigm that we really want is a way to actually sustainably coexist with fire. So we have to, in order to do that, we have to take action before, during, and after fires. We have to recognize the role of fire in our landscapes and learn about that. We have to grow local capacity. And like I mentioned, we have to grow a culture that actually accepts fire and understands its role in our landscape and in our community. And then we have to acknowledge that lots of communities are going to have a different experience with fire. So I love Northern California. As Yvonne said, I grew up in Hayfork. I came back here. But I've learned so much from working with different communities around the country. It's not the same story in Austin, Texas. And it's not the same story in Barnegat Township in New Jersey. And so I think it's really important to realize that we can't really franchise this kind of approach. What's going to work in the Mid-Klamath with the Karuk tribe and the folks that live on the river is not necessarily the same things that are going to work for our partners in Barnegat, New Jersey, with their Pineland Barrens and their retirement homes, which is most of their population there. So it's really important that we try to come up with tools that people can adapt and that the action takes place at that local level. We can't send down top-down approaches and hope for change. So now that I've kind of described some of the details of what fire adaptation looks like or can look like, I want to talk a little bit more about how the Watershed Center and our partners at the Nature Conservancy got involved in working with fire adaptation as a concept. So you might remember that cohesive strategy slide I had up there, the one I didn't like the silos in. In 2012, the Watershed Center got invited to work with the Cohesive Strategy folks in their Western region planning. And the project we got invited to do was to take a look at what the state of practice of fire adaptation in the West was. And we knew that people had been doing this work. We'd been doing the work in Hayfork for a long time, trying to, we weren't necessarily framing it as fire adapted communities, but we were trying to figure out how to live on a landscape that might burn, how to have jobs, how to protect our resources and our homes from burning down. We were trying to figure out how to have right fire for us and the landscape. And we knew that other communities were doing that work as well. And so, We were able to do this amazing project where we polled all these practitioners. So we had 575 respondents to the survey that we did. And these were all practitioners across the West. I remember as I was in the airport traveling to a workshop and I was trying to code these responses, and I was so horrified because some people were having like rude remarks in their surveys. But it was an amazing data set. So we asked them things like, where do you get your funding for this kind of work? Who else do you work with? Who do you know that does this work? What are the institutional arrangements that you have in your community? We asked really in-depth questions. It was a long survey. It was like a 45-minute survey. And we learned a ton of things. We learned that people were absolutely doing this work, but they were totally doing it isolated, and they were doing it basically in competition with other communities and sometimes even within their own community, because the main driver for doing the work was trying to capture grant funding, and that created this inherent competition and did not drive people towards working together at all. And it didn't even drive people towards sharing what they knew about what actually works. And so therein lay a big problem. Some people had innovated really cool approaches, but they were safeguarding those as kind of a way to keep getting money instead of being willing to share those with their neighbors and with the neighboring towns. And so with that kind of recognition, we realized that we could really move FAC practice forward if we could figure out how to get over that barrier, and if we could start articulating what was actually happening out there and where we needed to push the envelope further. And so, enter all these partners. The Watershed Center, as part of all of our community stewardship work, had been invited to be a part of the Fire Learning Network in 2006. And we had been doing wildfire work previous to that. Yvonne may have told you some stories about working on our original community wildfire protection plan in Trinity County. So we definitely had been sort of engaging in wildfire issues, but we hadn't necessarily been looking at fire as a central and key driver of our relationship to our landscape in the same way as I think we started to once we became involved with the Fire Learning Network. So the Fire Learning Network is this cool entity that was developed through a partnership with the Nature Conservancy, the Forest Service, and all of those other logos, which are the Departments of the Interior. And they came together to create a partnership to try to get quote unquote right fire back into landscapes. And their primary effort was around looking at places where the Nature Conservancy had big reserves and thinking about how they could make investments on public lands that were near those reserves. And so letting the Watershed Center into that club was sort of this like amazing community boon, because it was mostly for just for state chapters of TNC prior to that. But Lynn Decker, who's the lead of FLN, in her wisdom, knew that having community-based partnerships involved would bring this whole new set of practices and approaches that weren't necessarily being exhibited by, you know, state offices of the Nature Conservancy. And so we were able to join the FLN. Will Harling, some of you may know Will from the Mid-Klamath, and some of his partners also got involved in the FLN. And we started learning a whole bunch of new stuff about how we could engage in fire. I think that one of the main things we learned is that we could actually do fire. And that got people got really excited at our office about that. We're like, wait a minute, we could do prescribed burning? And so we started to build capacity for that. We have crews that get trained in that now. We've built a burn plan for our municipal watershed, which we've burned over 600 acres in now. We've made these huge leaps, but I don't think we would have necessarily done that if we hadn't been part of the FLN, which really let us see that there's a model out there where we could build this capacity and we could take fire on as something that we wanted to build like actual work around. So we had this, so the Watershed Center had this experience with the cohesive strategy where we saw that there were these isolated practitioners who were in competition with each other, and then we knew that networks could really open people's eyes to new kinds of practices. And so that was sort of this light bulb for us where we were like, hey, maybe we need to make a network. And so in 2013, we partnered with the Nature Conservancy and that other string of logos up there with those partners to create a new network. We launched the network with the purpose to demonstrate, innovate, and rapidly and broadly disseminate practices that improve community wildfire resilience. That's a big mouthful, but basically we were like, how are we going to get more people working on fire adaptation? And so we decided that to do that, we needed a learning network approach. So I'm going to tell you some like specific like definitions about a learning network now that I think are actually important to understanding like what our model is. So learning networks are relationship-based, and the power of networks is in the connections between the members that allow them to learn from each other, align with each other, and then take action together. So if you have these kind of nodes out there in your network that are not using their relationships to transfer knowledge and practice, then basically you just have a list of people. And so if you want to turn a list of people into a network, the first thing you have to do is get people to know each other, get people to trust each other, get people to start exploring with each other what they might be able to do better if they learn from what the other person is doing, or what they could do together that neither of them had been doing before. And so it's really about how to throw a great party in some ways. We do have great workshops and meetings. But it's more than just having fun together. It's also working on problems together. So a network approach is the right kind of approach when you want to solve a problem that requires an adaptive solution. So you might have problems that are super hard, like sending a rocket to space, but it's not necessarily an adaptive problem. There is a technical solution to how to build a rocket. And you can follow instructions and schematics, and you can build that. And that's easy to franchise that. I can send a blueprint, and if the people over there know how to read my blueprint, then they can take that blueprint and build my rocket. That's not necessarily an adaptive problem. But our wildfire issues are an adaptive problem. They're an adaptive problem because we're part of the because the actual players are part of the problem. We're creating the problem. Our systems are wholly inadequate to deal with the problem, and we need to have an entire paradigm shift and cultural shift. And so that's where using a network approach allows you to be constantly adapting and learning together about what the next thing to do is. So we don't necessarily have, you know, there's point B, and we're going to trace this line to get there. We have a North Star, and we're all sort of routing towards it. So we've built this network. Right now, we're trying to think about how we take all those relationships we've built and start answering these questions. So how are we actually learning from our members? What is it about FAC practice in New Jersey and the Mid-Klamath and Austin, Texas that is the same? Are there any things that are the same? If there are, how do we share those with other people? How do we work on things that aren't necessarily that well known or that maybe aren't agreed upon that much yet? You know, what do we do about how to interface with instant command? We don't have agreement throughout our network that that's the right thing to do, but it's an area where practice has not been explored. And so we're really trying to think about how do we start engaging and testing new ways where our practice is inadequate, where we aren't going to make that shift from the left-hand column of that paradigm chart because we don't have the right tools and practices to get us to a different kind of way of relating to fire. And then how are we going to use the network to help grow and catalyze all of that? So how are we going to put the network to work? So the ways that we're trying to do that, at least right now, and we're definitely adapting as we go, if nothing else, the network has given me all this gray hair and the way higher level of comfort at dealing with the unknown. I definitely feel like I was a person who liked to be in control and in charge of things and know what was going to happen next, and I have had to let go of that. So let me tell you a little bit about some of the nuts and bolts of how our network actually works. So up in the top left there, you see some of our members. This was an awesome trip I got to make to the Durango area this past fall, where we held a learning exchange. And a learning exchange is a very specific kind of event. The way we do learning exchanges within the network is we have different members decide that they want to learn about a topic, and then they co-create an agenda where they really focus on learning questions. And then the host organization tries to take us to places that are going to let us have rich conversation about those learning questions. So they don't set up a whole bunch of stops on a field tour and cart us around in a van and have a speaker and have like a little microphone thing and say, like, here's a treatment we did. We go in the field and we sit in a circle or stand there and try to talk about learning questions. And it's really hard to prep your like sites for that. People don't know how to do that in general. That's one of the things we've learned. People really want to give presentations. But it's amazing what happens when people go into the field and just start exploring learning questions together. I've made really good friends on learning exchanges, and it's super exciting and stimulating to just have kind of theoretical conversations, but using those places and using the fact that this isn't the place of a lot of these people. So several of these folks are from Arizona, and like I said, we were in Durango. So we're coming as outside people to look at a landscape, to ask these questions, and all kinds of new insights come out when you do that. We always say you can't be a prophet in your own land. And so I think that that's part of the power of these learning exchanges. You get new ideas and new people coming in, asking you questions about things that maybe you decided 3 years ago, and have forgotten that you made that decision about how to understand that, and these people bring up those things again. So that's a really key element, and I think our network members have gained a ton from those exchanges. We also have an annual kind of get-together. It's an annual workshop. We play games. These people in the bottom are playing an amazing trivia night that I created. It was super fun. There was a lot of drinking and big prizes. It was great. But having an opportunity to all come together for an entire week and explore deeply what their FACT practices is has been amazing for our members. Most of these people work with 10 or 12 partners in their own community, and no one else knows what they're talking about. This is kind of a new field. And so getting to come to a workshop where there's 100 people who are totally bought in to your vision of a different way to live with fire and who get how hard your job is and are going to help you figure out how to do it better, it's really fun. People love our annual workshops. We also have webinars, and we host a ton of other specific workshops to help people deal with specific issues. So sometimes people have like a technical question or a problem. Earlier today, we had a fellow from the fire department in Rapid City, South Dakota, who's really trying hard to figure out how to burn a section that's like parkland in the middle of their city, and they have like no idea how to go about this. So we were able to get a bunch of people from our network on the phone with him who've done burning like that, and they were able to talk about like the steps that he might take, some partners he should engage, and we call that sort of a peer assist. And so we do a lot of those kind, we sort of figure out what opportunities there are for those and then make those kinds of things happen. Sometimes those happen as webinars, sometimes they're calls, sometimes it's me talking to one other person. Those things take a lot of different forms, but the key element there is that we have within our network staff who act as liaisons to our members. And our main job as staff liaisons is to deeply understand what the people in our network are doing and then try to figure out who else in the network could help them or who outside the network might be able to help them. And then the process, the practice in kind of network speak that we use is called net weaving. So then our job is to be like, let me connect you to you. You don't know this guy. You should really meet this person. They're going to be able to help you. And then we facilitate that exchange. Some of the other things that we have are really cool special projects. So in that upper left hand corner is a picture of a CMAT team. This is an idea that was born completely kind of out of the network. And the idea was, what if instead of like fire suppression teams, we had community mitigation support teams, and we had sort of fire adaptation practitioners that get deployed to other places, and they come in and they try to think about helping people. So I was able to go on this like pilot project, and we went up to Chelan, Washington, in the Wenatchee area, and it was really amazing to work on kind of like a fire assignment. We were there for 14 days. We had to work like 14-hour days, all of those days. It was really incredible. We did not sleep on the ground, so that was like kind of cheating. But it was still amazing to get to interact with that community. They had the Wolverine fire was the fire that was in their area, and so they sent us out just ahead of that fire. We had like 2 days ahead of the fire, and we'd go out and try to help the local volunteer fire departments and auxiliaries figure out how to communicate with their residents about what they could do right now that would maybe help when the fire got there. So they're not going to fix their roofs at that point, but they can move their wood piles. And so we were able to come and help give them that kind of last minute advice. So this idea was super exciting to the woman on the kind of right hand side of that picture, Pam Leschek, and she works for the Washington Office of the Forest Service and has now been able to carry this concept to the leadership of the Forest Service, and they're piloting this all over the country. So we're sort of this cool incubator of ideas. We also get to work with some of our other partners from those logos I showed earlier. That partnership of the Nature Conservancy, the Forest Service, and the Departments of the Interior has several other components to that partnership. So they have a program called TREX, which is prescribed fire training exchanges, and they are amazing events. Lania, again, ran the first women's TREX this last fall, and that program was life-changing to the people who went to it. There's going to be more women's TREXs, so women who want to get into fire management, stay tuned. We're making space for you. It's really, really cool work, and I think part of the basis of why they wanted to do that is, I think, important to fire adaptation, and it's that, you know, if our suppression paradigm isn't working, then we need new approaches to how to deal with fire. And part of that is to try to have a variety and diversity of people engage with fire. So not just our typical male fire crews. We really need way more diverse people engaged in fire. We do some other stuff, like make handouts about our work, and we have a really cool blog. Today is our 300th blog post on our blog, which is amazing to me. I was like, wow, we've done a lot of writing. There's really cool stories on there, though, so I encourage you to check it out. We also work really hard to support our partner land management agencies, because those folks, I mean, they're the ones who are funding this effort for one thing. So we really need to think about, are they getting what they need out of their investment they're making in the network and the communities we work with? But we also have recognized that their own staff are in need of figuring out how to apply fire adapted communities concepts. And so we work with people from the Park Service and the Forest Service and the BLM, and we've done some really cool projects with them. So One example is in Washington State, one of their BLM foresters heard about our network and got so excited that he was able to find his own pot of BLM money to start a Washington network, which I have the water bottle of right here. It's amazing. They have their own state network modeled just exactly after the national network, and they have been able to work with their state to get funding. They're working with the Department of Commerce. They're totally out there pioneering, like, complete community resilience. They're working on business issues. They're working on recovery stuff. They are just pushing forward, and that's been an amazing opportunity that's all facilitated by this one guy at the BLM thinking about how he could use his small pot of money, about $50,000, to seed a whole state effort. So we get to be involved with that kind of stuff. And the last piece that's really important about our network is that thing at the very bottom corner, which is a screenshot of our Podio space. And so for people wanting to try to create a network, especially a nationwide network, you know, how are you going to keep up your friendships with those buddies that you drank and learned with if you can't talk to them for a year? You're not going to do it. So we have this online workspace that lets people talk to each other all the time. So it's kind of like Facebook, but it's really like project management meets Facebook. And so people are able to post things on the wall, they share stuff, they're like, this is what's going on with me today, this is like, I'm struggling with this problem, does anyone have a solution? We had a really cool exchange the other day where one guy was like, we've got all these homeless people on our BLM land, and like, they want to engage with me about fire, and I don't know what to say to them. And another guy was like, well, here's how we've done that. We went out and we actually worked with the shelters. We gave the people apps on their phones, because a lot of the transients in their area had phones or tablets, to be able to report fires accurately. And so we were able to get all these examples from around the country of different ways that people have approached engaging that part of their population. And this guy was like, great, now I have like 12 ideas to choose from, where I was just sort of stymied before and didn't even know how to move forward. So Podio is really critical for us. So what can you do here? How does the fact that I have a network that's a national network even apply to you guys? We have a few ways you can engage. One thing you can do is you can work locally. So you can get in touch with your local Fire Safe Council. Humboldt has a great one. I encourage you. You can also connect with other FAC practitioners on our website. Like I said before, we have that amazing blog with 300 posts on it. And you can make profiles on that site too, so that you can engage with other practitioners. You can also read more about that Fort Complex that I was talking about at the beginning of this presentation. I wrote a blog about that has more of the kind of story behind that. So just to close out, I want to take you back to Hayfork for a minute. So this is the view from another one of our fire lookouts. This is Hayfork Bali. Super beautiful. And this is what I hope. I hope that the next time we have a lightning bust that sends up smoke columns across this landscape, that my community is ready and that we don't need to have all of those fire suppression resources come to town, that we've done the work around town to let fire play its natural role in our landscape, and that we are more resilient as a community and that we're ready. We just can't keep punting this problem into the future. We have to start taking action. And I hope that you guys will take action. I think a lot of people think about the redwoods as not a place where there's fire, but redwoods are fire adapted. That's why they have that amazing bark. And more so than my landscape, the redwoods are more departed from your natural fire regime. We've continued having fires because it's so rugged and hard to control them. But fires here have been successfully suppressed. And so it's not sort of a matter of if, but when fire will return here. And I invite you guys to be ready and engaged. So I hope this talk's offered you an alternative way to think about wildfire and to think about community resilience and about your role in having a more sustainable and resilient future. Thanks.